are shit. Oh, yes, I say, giving the empathetic bartender nod of acknowledgement, which is not actually the same as agreement, but people who drink a lot tend to miss the nuance. I've actually heard that one before. Of course you have. Flatus chugs her third pint and demands another in an utterly sober voice, and it's at this point that Mathieu starts to look a bit scared. I can see that part of him wants to leave, but his desire to see what happens next keeps him firmly planted in his seat. Pint 4. Flatus curls her hand around it, hunches over somewhat, and only now, it seems, will she nurse it and tell me what happened. But first she delivers a belch that's long and robust, supporting and sustaining the note from the diaphragm like a trained singer. Mathieu nearly swoons.
Perun broke up with me,
she announces in English. What? I'm truly stunned. Perun had been completely besotted with her. When did this happen?
Couple days ago in Scotland. Some fairy stole his thunder, and I destroyed her with cold iron, and he got mad and turned into an eagle and flew away, and now it's done. All my fault, too.
No, I say. I have so many questions, and I can see that Mathieu does as well, but job number one here is reassurance, and I throw a warning look at my regular. If he opens his mouth now, it won't end well for him. It can't be all your fault.
Yes. Yes, it is, because, you know, I betrayed him.
You did?
Yup.
Uh-huh. How did you do that?
Well, that fairy who stole his thunder, I knew she was gonna do that, and I knew he was gonna get it back, because I'm a huntress. I hunt shite down, right? Including fairies. Perfectly safe. Killer!
Flitish brings her fist down so hard on the bar that the wood splinters and Mathieu flinches.
And he gets his thunder back. That's exactly what happened. I had a plan and that plan worked. Mostly.
She raises her fist and waggles a finger at me.
But see, I didn't tell him first.
Oh.
Oh, he's right. I didn't get his consent. I used him.
She turns to Mathieu and leers at him, switching from Old Irish to English.
Usually men like it when I use them.
Mathieu gulps and slides his eyes over to me for a cue. I give him a tight nod.
I can see how they would,
he manages to say in English. Flitish chuckles, her eyes apprising him, and I quickly step in before she can take it any further, pointedly using Old Irish. But Perun didn't like it, I guess? That draws her attention back to me.
No, he said he had a good time with me, but now the time is over.
She raises her left hand in the air and her fingers flutter in it.
He flew back to Russia, or somewhere Slavic, I don't know. And it happened so fast I didn't even understand what I'd done wrong. I was still standing there, thinking I'd done the right thing because that fairy had been violating treaties with the Scots, and it was only the result that mattered. But he was gone. I didn't have time to process it, to step outside my own stupid headspace and look at what I'd done from his perspective. I didn't even get to say I was sorry.
Her voice catches at the end, and I can see her eyes filling, and I'm struck by so many thoughts at once. Here is a truly ancient person, feeling heartbroken and rejected, and it's no different from the heartbreak someone would feel who was born 20 years ago. And, oh, baby, you done fucked up bad. And, oh, honey, at least you know it, and you're gonna be a better person from now on. And, oh, shit, if I say the wrong thing right now, she will kill my ass. I should probably not say, for example, that if Atticus ever did something like that to me, I would most likely do the same thing as Perun. No matter what I say, though, she might pay me a visit later if she feels embarrassed about opening herself up to me, and I think Flitish is probably that sort. It had taken her 60 ounces of beer to relax the tight control she kept over herself, and once she sobered up, she might not want there to be any living witness to her moment of vulnerability. I need to bring my A-game. I lean over the bar, get as close as I can without touching her, and say, if you still want to tell him you're sorry tomorrow or 100 years from now, you're going to get that chance. Because you're going to be around. And maybe when you say it, there will be forgiveness and it'll be good. And if there isn't forgiveness, then it will still be good, because you will have done what's right. He deserves that apology. And in the meantime, there is beer and blood and the songs of bards, the great wide world to live in, and all the plains, too. Fleddish nods. A tear escapes and runs down her cheek, and she raises her glass.
Beer,
she says, and I rear back, horrified, while she chugs that fourth pint, swaying in her seat as she does so. I have made such an awful mistake. I flick my hand at Maciej and whisper at him urgently in Polish to run. Go, just run, run, I'm serious. Thank the gods of all the pantheons, he trusts me. Maciej slides off his stool and backs toward the door, keeping a wary eye on Fliddish. And as he moves away and the goddess of the hunt puts down her glass unsteadily and it topples over, her motor skills deteriorating rapidly, some douche lord moves up on her left and offers to buy her another drink. He even puts a hand on her shoulder. Every word he says is in Polish, but that doesn't matter. His tone is condescending. He's clearly a predator. And because I love poetry and alliteration and all the ways in which words can sound delightful when strung together, I had unthinkingly given Fliddish the worst possible advice.
Blood,
she says, and she promptly spills his by smashing her fist into his nose, a sharp left-handed backhand like she was signaling a right-hand turn on a bicycle. It's casual, so she doesn't kill him, but he's knocked out and bleeding on the floor, and there are plenty of witnesses. It's pretty clear I'm going to be fired and quite possibly sued for serving so much alcohol to a customer so quickly. Fliddish frowns at the man sprawled on the floor.
That was disappointing, she says. We was hoping for a spirited fracas.
If you'll forgive me, I think we should have discussed your goals a bit earlier. I was hoping not to have a fracas at all. I'm going to have to change the sign in the back to days without a fracas. Zero. Fliddish hears me but does not care, because the man's friends have lurched from wherever they'd been watching to hurl some choice Polish epithets at her. She can't understand them. I'm not sure I understand half of them myself. But she can read their aggressive postures well enough. She smiles, sets herself, and beckons them forward. There are three of them, none especially in shape, and I think at least one of them is aware of it. But two charge forward, unable to resist a good goad, and my pleading shouts to stop go ignored. Fliddish purposely stops them with a flurry of quick jabs to the face, and when they raise their hands, she sternly rebukes their groins with a powerful fist to the junk. They wilt like cabbage in boiling water and collapse on top of their unconscious friend. The third one prudently decides to preserve his procreative package and backpedals into the bar crowd, which is now aghast and staring.
Fliddish! Fliddish! Let's talk in the back, okay? Come on.
Nope. Too late. The bouncer has come over to bounce Fliddish, and she drops him even harder since he's fairly skilled and able to get at least a single punch through her drunken defenses.
Okay, really now? Let's talk? We need to go before the police get here. The modern police! The ones with guns!
Yes, your shenanigans will bring them for sure.
Very well. I'm finished drinking anyway.
She half staggers around as I raise the bar flip-top and let her pass through into the back. Maciej's at the door, staring wide-eyed through the glass pane set in the middle of it, and he mouths a thank you to me for saving him. I give him a salute and follow Fliddish into the kitchen area. I guide her to the back, where the employee lockers are and a sign hanging on the wall says in Polish, days since a workplace accident. It has the number 173 underneath it, but I pointedly change it to zero. Half a year since the last fracas, Fliddish, and you ruined it.
Why is it shagri?
Fliddish sways as she hooks a thumb over her shoulder.
Man ruined it!
Your speech is deteriorating. Will you please heal yourself of alcohol poisoning? We're going to need clear heads to get out of this. Fliddish delivers a spluttery sigh like an impatient horse.
Fine!
Piotr Skrobiszewski, the manager of the pub, storms into the kitchen at that point, shouting in Polish.
Where is she? Where the hell is she?
Pardon me, I tell Fliddish. I dart around her, find the manager, and sweep his legs. He knows English, so I pounce on top of him, pin his arms, and shout in his face, "Hi! I quit! I'm leaving in 2 minutes! The woman who knocked out 3 men in the bar will kill anyone, including you, without a second thought! I'm trying to get her out of here before anyone actually dies. So just let us go, and you'll all see the sunrise, okay?" I slap his face companionably a couple of times. "Thanks for letting me work here a while, Pyotr. You're a good guy." I launch myself off my stunned former employer and wave at the slack-jawed line cook as I return to the goddess of the hunt. "Feeling better yet?" I ask her as I move to my locker and spin the combination on my padlock.
"Yes, a moment,"
she replies, her eyes closed. The tumblers click, I yank open the door, unbind my staff from the back of the locker, and pluck it out. "Let's go, please, we really can't stay." Thank the gods of all the pantheons, she follows me out the back door into a dank alleyway. We hear sirens approaching, and I lead Flitish to Pola Mokotovskaya, the large park in the center of Warsaw where we can find plenty of privacy and a bound tree if necessary. She laughs when we hit the turf of it, feeling safe again with the earth underneath her feet.
"That was not a fair fight," she admits, "but I do feel better somehow."
"I hope you have an excellent reason for coming into my bar and getting me fired."
"Fired? You quit. I heard you.
I had to quit because of what you did."
"Oh. Why were you working there anyway?"
"For many reasons. To learn Polish, to make money, to lure vampires in so that I may unbind them."
"Vampires?"
"That's what I said, yes. They made a treaty with us, and we're supposed to be out of Poland by now, but they've refused to leave because of one Kacper Głowa."
"He is also a vampire."
"Yes."
"You should hunt him down and unbind him."
"I agree. I would love to do that. I'm not very good at the hunting bit, though, which is why I was working in the pub, hoping he or one of his associates would show up. One of them had appeared there before."
"I will hunt him for you. Where was he last seen?"
"I've never seen him, but I can take you to one of his nests. May I ask what brought you to my bar tonight? Something about a message from Briat?" Flitish waves that away.
"Later. Let's hunt a vampire."
"He may be many miles away."
"I could use a good hunt."
There's a bound black poplar tree in the park that we used to shift to a wooded hill above Krakow, and I feel a grin spread across my face as the two of us jog to one of Kacper Głowa's safe houses. There were 4 of them scattered around a block, each one with a concealed stairway leading to an impressive subterranean complex. There is nothing dull about being a druid. The study period is long and intense, but the payoff is tremendous. Earlier I was pouring beers, and now I'm hunting vampires with a goddess. We break into the abandoned house, step past the bloodstains to the staircase, and descend into the dark. At the bottom I find a light switch on the wall and flick it on, gratified to see the electricity still works.
"There were 12 of them down here,"
Flitish asks. "Yes. Thralls, too. And room for more. Głowa owns all this, but wasn't here himself when we raided it."
"All right. We need to pick up his trace somehow. Let us see what can be found."
I follow her through the complex, moving from room to room, some of them riddled with bullet holes or smeared with blood on the walls. Flitish grunts periodically, but says nothing as she inspects it all. Finally, she unslings her bow and removes her quiver, placing them carefully on the ground.
"Normally I have my own hounds to help me with this,"
she says, pulling off her vest.
"But in this case, I will have to do the thing itself."
She strips to the skin and shifts her shape into her predator form, the tattoo for which looks similar to Atticus's, but turns out to be a breed of hound that doesn't properly exist anymore. Hounds have changed quite a bit since Flitish was first bound to Gaia. She's not far away from a red wolf, and if I had to settle on a species, that's what I'd call her, since her coat is somewhat tawny. The huntress takes another circuit of the compound, her nose down and snuffling as she goes. She has to sneeze several times. I imagine the dusty skin cells of the undead have to be irritating to the nose. I certainly do not want to shift to a jaguar to find out. She spends an inordinately long time in one particular room, which serves as a library. Dark cherrywood bookcases line the walls, some of them now splattered with blood. Rich leather, upholstered armchairs squat next to varnished tables. They used to have vintage Tiffany lamps on them, but these are now shattered on the floor, colorful shards of the past. I do appreciate the smell of the room with my unenhanced human senses, pipe tobacco and old paper. I check some of the titles they have on the shelves, and it's not long before my jaw drops. They have first editions of Poland's finest. I hesitate to touch the four-volume Chłopi by Władysław Reymont, who won the Nobel Prize in 1924. But not for too long. I can't resist. And once I flip to the title page of Volume 1 and see that it's signed, my head swims with a treasure, and I'm overcome with the temptation to steal it. An old Jane's Addiction tune starts playing in my head. "Do you think anyone would notice if I took this?" I ask, turning to Flittish. She looks up briefly, nods her wolf head slowly and deliberately, then trots out of the room, keeping eye contact with me. She expects me to follow. So I do, after returning the book to its shelf, all the way to the spot where she left her clothes. She shifts back to human, puts a finger to her lips, and shakes her head to make doubly sure I know not to speak. I nod my understanding and plant myself in the hallway as she dresses, watching our trail from the library. There would be no reason to be quiet if someone were not here. No one comes, however, and I hear nothing. Flittish collects her bow and quiver and gestures that we should return upstairs. She wants me to go first, however. She knocks an arrow in her bow and backs slowly up the stairs, watching our six. That gives me a shiver. We emerge from the stairs and I say, "What?" But Flittish draws her hand across her throat to cut me off.
"Not yet," she whispers.
I follow her outside, and she takes us all the way down the block before she halts, kneels, and speaks in very low tones in Old Irish.
"How well did you search that compound?"
We thought we were thorough. I'm sure Leif was, too.
"So you searched the rooms behind the library?"
"What rooms?"
"There are passages behind the bookcases. Tremendous traffic through there, and scents of vampires that did not match the scents of the slain ones. The smells are recent, too."
"Are you saying there are vampires in there right now, and they could hear us mucking around?"
"That is indeed what I'm saying, especially if there are some modern surveillance devices installed, which I suspect may be the case. If we go back, we may find they have emerged, or else they will hear us approach and hide again."
"So there must be some kind of Scooby-Doo lever that opens up a secret passage."
"What is Scooby-Doo?"
A long-running television show that demonstrated to everyone what a terrible idea it was to wear an ascot. The protagonist solved mysteries in old houses that frequently had secret passages behind bookcases, always activated by moving a particular book or a small knick-knack or even a torch in a wall sconce. There has to be a way through.
"We can unbind the cellulose of the wood, if nothing else."
"So we're doing this? We're going to go down there and slay the undead?"
"Is that not why we traveled here?"
"Okay, I'm up for it. But before we go, I'd really like to hear that message from Briat."
"Oh yes, I nearly forgot. Ragnarok is coming soon."
"What? How could you forget something like that?"
The goddess shrugs.
"Because I am not to be involved in the primary fracas. Sheehan and Owen will be engaged in the main battle, along with many others. But we have heard of a building disturbance on the other side of the planet on an island named Taiwan. Are you familiar with it?"
"Yes."
"Apparently it is to be the origin of the second major front. So you and I are tasked with containing whatever emerges at the site of the smaller, secondary, and inevitably lesser fracas. This is to ensure I won't run into Pirun, you see."
"That may indeed be the reason behind what they're doing, but it doesn't sound like light duty. It could be one heck of a major fracas, just you and me against who knows what?"
"Well, somebody does know what, or at least is supposed to have a fair idea. We're going to go see him first. I've been given directions and passwords and a rare fruit from Munnan and MacLear's Isle of Apples."
"Who is it we're seeing?"
"Some man named Sun Wukong."
"Holy shit! Flittish, you're not joking with me right now, are you?"
"I do not jest. That is whom we are supposed to see. Why, do you know him?"
"Only by reputation. Sun Wukong is the name of the Monkey King."
Chapter 4 I return to the sandstone buttes of the Navajo Nation, baked red and gold in the sun,
and found a place to wait high above the arroyos cut by flash floods. I built a spare smoky fire out of the creosote branches, folded my legs underneath me, and communed with the elemental Colorado. I waited most of the day, skin cooking slowly among the rocks, and wondered if I wasn't wasting my time. I'd already made a couple of other calls before coming, but it wasn't like I had no other preparations to make. I couldn't afford to wait past nightfall, and I had to heal from sunburns several times. He arrived late in the afternoon, the hottest part of the day, dust-caked jeans and boots scuffing the rock, a simple black t-shirt tucked in and a cowboy hat resting on top of long black hair.
"Hello, Mr. Druid," Coyote said, trying to peer around my body, looking for something. "Where's your hound?" "I brought sausages."
He held up a greasy bag, and I winced in regret. "Oh, he's gonna be upset that he missed seeing you. He's in Oregon."
"Well, damn. I mostly came to see him."
"Thanks a lot."
"Don't act like it's news. He's always been your better half."
"I won't argue with you."
"Well, damn it all again. That's the only other reason I came. Guess I have no business being here."
"Coyote, please," I said as he turned away. "May I beg a few minutes? It could lead to a fine argument. You might even win." He halted, pivoted with a grinding noise underneath his boot heels, and considered me with pursed lips. After a long silence of holding my eyes in a staring contest, he finally replied,
"You know how to push my buttons, don't you, Mr. Druid? You know I can't resist arguing with a white man."
"You'd probably enjoy Twitter then, but I wouldn't push it if it weren't important." Coyote tossed the bag down and settled himself across the fire from me, peering through curling vines of smoke.
"All right, then. Bring it."
"I need your help." "No," he snorted and flashed a grin. "That was quick." "It's not just me, Coyote."
"Honestly, Mr. Druid, I don't care who you're representing here. Why should I help you instead of helping my own people?"
"Because there's a narcissist with a bunch of cronies who wants to burn down the whole world, your piece of it included, for no other reason than to stoke his own ego and profit besides."
"So, kind of like an American president, then?"
I gaped for a second as I tried to make the connection, then closed my mouth. "Yeah, kind of like that."
"Well, I seen men like that before, Mr. Druid. I've survived them, and my people survived them, too. And I'm pretty sure we'll outlast this new one. And before you say anything," he said,
pointing a finger at me through the smoke,
"let me remind you that you never lifted a dainty finger yours to help us fight off all of them presidents. And not just us, but all the tribes. And hey, I'll be a sweaty sack of nuts if you ever helped with all them settlers and soldiers who did their best to wipe us out. Never mind the presidents. Don't try to tell me you're in the same boat as us either. Ain't no way we could have helped the Druids out against the coming of the Christians. But you could have helped us, and you chose not to."
"That's not true. I couldn't help. I was hiding from Angus Ogg and had to limit my magic usage."
"Well, I understand that, Mr. Druid. I surely do. So I hope you'll understand when I say we gotta limit our dying for white man's causes."
"But you don't die."
"Oh, I die, all right. I thought I made that clear before. The fact that I keep coming back don't mean I don't die. My people die, too. But still, we endure. Getting involved in this thing you're talking about doesn't sound like the best way to keep doing that. I figure the best thing to do, since y'all have mostly forgotten about us, is let you fight it out and we'll enjoy the peace afterward."
I deflated for a moment, defeated. "Okay. Fair enough. I don't think you'll be left alone, or that there'll be a lot of peace afterward if we don't stop him, but I do see that you've done more than your fair share of fighting dudes who think the world is theirs to take. That's legit."
"Oh, well, thank thank you so much for validating my feelings, Mr. Druid. I was really hoping you would. Gonna sleep real well tonight. Normally, I have to pop melatonin pills down my throat like candy, you know, because some white man hasn't told me I'm right recently.
Sorry. That obviously didn't come across as I intended. I'm trying to agree with you. But this guy can probably take the world if anyone can. I'm talking about Loki of the Norse pantheon. He's gonna bring a legion of the undead, a good number of fire and frost giants, and who knows what other allies with him. You might be safe here for a while on this side of the world, but if he's not stopped on the other side, by the time he gets here, there will be no stopping him. I shook my head at the scale of what was about to be unleashed. If Loki wasn't stopped before he could build momentum, it would be because I failed to stop him. It would be because I had been stopped. This is gonna start day after tomorrow, probably, somewhere in Scandinavia. If you want to help, that's where to show up.
What kind of help do you think I can give, Mr. Druid? I ain't some mighty warrior who's gonna come in there and rally the troops to charge or whatever.
I know. You're not gonna pucker up and blow the horn of Helm Hammerhand. I want you to do something that you're uniquely qualified to do. I want you to assassinate Hel.
What? Are you talking about that half-dead woman who showed up to recruit you here that one time? And because of her Frank Chiz Chili summoned monster slayer?
That's the one. She's the Norse goddess of the underworld, the daughter of Loki, and she can raise the dead. So once they start killing some folks, she can add them into their army, and you can see how that's gonna quickly grow out of control. Removing Hel's the key to keeping the fight manageable, if just barely.
If she can raise the dead, then can't she raise herself if I kill her?
Well, no, because she has to be alive to do that, and in this hypothetical, thanks to you, she'd be dead. She would still be ruler of the underworld, and she would have an existence there, but like the Morrigan, she would be a shadow of her former self. She wouldn't be able to manifest on Midgard again in time to make any difference in Ragnarok.
Huh. Is she gonna be stomping around all 12 feet tall and stanky like raw chicken gone bad?
She might be. But she might be in disguise, too. You can see through those, right?
Coyote smirked.
Yeah. I know a thing or two about disguises, Mr. Druid.
Well, I hope you'll consider it. Because she has been here before, and she won't forget about you if they make it to this side of the world. The trickster sniffed, hawked something up, and spat in the fire.
Sure. I'll consider it.
Good.
I imagine you have other places to be, other folks to see.
I do.
Fires to put out and whatnot. Well, don't worry about this one here. I'll take care of it.
I got to my feet, slapped the red dust off my ass, and nodded to Coyote.
Thanks.
See you around.
Maybe, Mr. Druid. But probably not. Tell your dog I said hi, though.
Chapter 5. A fen is not really a synonym for a bog, though it is rather wet and something of a mire. Its chemistry is different, though, so you get a different set of plants growing there. Mostly grasses, and the occasional scraggly tree, thin and fragile things. You might think it's a handsome plain until you step in it and the mud hugs your foot like a hungry python. The Morrigan's fen looks fine, just fine, until Coriander and I step away from the bound tree and see we have to cross it to get to the structure where Fand and Manon and MacLear must be hiding. I don't rightly know what to call it. It's not a castle or a manor or even a house, more of a gothic nightmare of architecture. Like if the Morrigan had found a mason wandering in an opium haze and said, "Make it all forbidding and ominous. Maybe a splash of drooling madness and a dollop of gibbering batshit." Dark and writhing shapes in some bits, pointy parts in others, and sometimes the black shines with a high gloss, and sometimes it lies flat, like old standing coffee, ready to grow a layer of mould on top. The low grey sky doesn't help to cheer it up any, nor do the croaking crows. It's just me that has to wade through the fen, it turns out. Coriander floats above it, and he does so just a wee smidge ahead of me so that I can see how easy it is for him. I mutter curses at him, and he smirks, enjoying it. Halfway across me legs all slimed and squidgy, I see some upright lads with wild hair approaching in the distance. A bit closer and I see they're not lads, they're swords and dead eyes. Bark instead of skin, a mobile set of roots instead of feet, poling them across the fen like so many stilts. Human. I put on the brass knuckles Crenya gave me, fully charged with energy. They let me shatter stone. Should work just fine on a hardwood. That is, if I can get close enough to punch them without being sliced into cutlets. The Morrigan's human aren't fooled by camouflage, and I'm not going to be terribly speedy in a fen. Go sick 'em, fuckstick, I says to the herald extraordinary.
I can do no more than accustom, sir. I am incapable of instigating violence.
Give yourself some credit, lad. Just go talk to them and I bet they try to kill ye. The herald extraordinary rolls his eyes at me and sighs like a phantom squeezing out a vengeful fart. But he floats toward the human without fear. Once he reaches them and starts talking, they treat him like an obstacle in the landscape. That is, they don't engage. They just go around him. Coriander floats back, plants himself in front of one or the other, but they know the score. Just patiently flank him and keep advancing to the target. Me. That's not working, damn it! I holler at him. Get back here, fuckstick! I have a better idea! He speeds back to me, frowning in disapproval, and the human keep coming at their measured pace.
I really must protest your abusive language, sir.
I know, I'm a right bastard, but like I said, save me arse, and I'll take the trouble to use four syllables. I want you to float right in front of me here, just a bit to me left, though, because it looks like they're right-handed. We're gonna let ye take their hits, and I'll counterpunch. Speed up with me now, we're flanking to their left. Make them adjust. I move to the right, and the human have to respond. There's no way I can allow them to surround me. I won't have a defense against blades coming from all directions. If I move and strike and move again, I should be able to survive and outrun them once I'm past. I'd simply shift to a kite and fly over them, were it not that three in the back have bows, waiting for just that. I'll have to make sure the herald covers me arse if I make it past the phalanx here. For about 6 seconds, I think maybe I'll outrun them. And then they find another gear somewhere, or just have no trouble in the muck like I do, and they take a good angle. They're gonna have a shot at me. The leader whips one of his long arm-like branches out in front of me, low to the ground, and it's a fine gambit. Trip me up in this muck and I'm probably not gonna get up again. But I see it coming, and hang back just a wee bit, letting coriander float into it first. And those kinetic wards of his do the trick. The branch rebounds off him and spins the human away. But reducing me speed like that has its cost. The second human thrusts his branch around the back of coriander and I duck just in time. It opens a searing lash of pain across me shoulder blades and I curse the fairy for being an incompetent shield. Do ye know how angry Briot's gonna be if ye let me die? I say, trying to keep up my speed.
It is difficult to quantify, sir. Mildly vexed at a short-term inconvenience, for sure. But life is long, and her anger, like her fires, tends to die out after a while.
That response chills me guts 5 degrees or so. He really could let the human have me and shrug it off. It's not like the human don't have a reputation for being damn fine murderers. He'd have no trouble suggesting that they were more than a match for the two of us. As he's talking, though, two of the yeomen make incidental contact with coriander while trying to get to me, and they're both blown back like a hurricane uprooted them. The one that sliced up me back is gonna try again, but I'm watching the bastard and waiting. Let Coriander deal with the lads out front trying to trip me. I can handle this one who's hoping to pull off a deadly reach around. That thick branching arm of his with sharp stick fingers whips out again, and I lurch to a halt, letting it pass in front of me. A claw scrapes across me chest, and a flight of arrows from the archers passes in front of where I was gonna be, two of them flying through, and one rebounding off Coriander. I grab the human's woody wrist with me right hand, and then punch straight through the bow with the knuckles on me left, splinters gouging me arm. Human are silent, but I can tell he fears it. He stops the chase, and I pick up speed again, taking his hand with me. One more human is denied in his attempt to trip me, and he's spun out of the pursuit, leaving one that we haven't passed yet, plus the archers, and I'm careful to put Coriander between us now. This lad wants to take a swipe at me with his sword. His right arm visibly lengthens as he matches speeds with us, his arm trailing behind, his plan plain to see. "What's that shite?" I say. "He's gonna whip that around back."
"I am aware, sir,"
the herald replies, his manner calm and unruffled, as he floats above the fin, and I churn me legs through it. It's a crafty strategy the human's chosen. To counter it, Coriander will have to stop, and that will do two things. Allow the lads we've passed to catch up a bit, and leave me exposed to a volley from the archers if I don't stop in time. I peek around at the archers and see they're all ready and waiting for me to break cover again. Fucking hells! This human's arm isn't tough and woody like the other one. It's limber and flexible and meant to bend instead of snap. So even when it runs into Coriander's wards, that arm and sword are gonna keep whipping around my way. Bollocks! The branch yaws back and around, building all the tension it can with the sword clutched at the end, and then it releases, and Coriander halts to meet it. I'm immediately exposed, and the archers let fly. Nothing for it. I dive headfirst into the fin, stretching out, and ready for the sting of foul water in me wounds. The arrows pass over me head, and so does the curl of the sword. But all me momentum's gone, and I'm covered in muck, and I may have squashed an unlucky frog. The human's arm whips away, and I can see the archers reloading. A glance over me shoulder confirms the others are trying to make up that lost ground. "Come on, Coriander, while me horse is still attached," I says, giving him the four syllables he wanted. I lurch up out of the sucking mud and stagger forward, trying to build up speed again. Coriander screens me from the next volley of arrows, and then we're past, moving too quickly for the human to catch up. Not that they stop trying, we just have to keep going and hope we don't run into some booby trap ahead. A mist rolls in from the Morgan's gothic horror show of a house, and I can tell by the way it behaves it's not natural, nor is it a mere binding. It's Mananin's cloak of mists, which means I'm about to be lost in the fog shortly before being pounded into stew meat. I shout into it as it envelops me. "I'm here to talk, damn it, not fight! I'm here with a herald! Put your cloak away, Mananin, and let's spill some whiskey instead of blood!" The mist halts, then retreats like it's being sucked down a drain, and when it's gone, there's a long-bearded man standing there in a white tunic, his blue eyes cold. Mananin looks tired, aged too. There's some grey in his beard, methinks, which wasn't there before. I think those magic youth-restoring hogs of his are still back in Tiernanog. Or perhaps his disposition isn't suited to being a rebel. Or perhaps it's my imagination, and it's the dreary atmosphere of the fen that makes him look so weary and chewed up. "Can we talk, Mananin? I've come with this Coriander lad who's supposed to be well known, and I bring an offer from the first among the fae." A single eyebrow quirks up at that news. "An offer? Or terms of surrender?" "Definitely an offer. No surrender involved, for you or Fand." Mananin's eyes shift behind me shoulder, and he raises a hand to halt the human. "Stop! My last order is rescinded!" I turn and see the human there, approaching from behind. They halt a safe distance away, and Mananin dismisses them. "Our selection of whiskies may not be so rare as the last time we dined,"
he tells me. But you're welcome at our table, Owen O'Kinnaty. And choice well, Coriander. We'll hear they suffer.
That's very kind of ye, Mananin. We draw close, and I see that it's not me imagination. The face of the god of the sea looks like someone crumpled it up and then tried to stretch it flat again. Lines of stress all over it. He made a hard choice when Fand rebelled, and had he chosen Breit's side over his wife's, I don't think he'd look any different. He'd be miserable regardless, and I think I can empathize. Or is it sympathize? I feckin' hate English. But whatever the proper word is, I see a smidgen of his problem. I am caught between Greta and Sheehan, and hope I never have to choose between the two. Luckily, they're merely estranged, and not actively trying to destroy each other. Which reminds me, I owe the Herald some kindness, and I pay him while we walk. Coriander, lad, that was some fine saving of me arse ye did back there. Thank ye for keeping me alive to this point. I know I can be an angry, hollering tit, and... well, I just wanted ye to know I'm not that way all the feckin' time. The Herald raises one corner of his mouth.
Indeed. And for how much time, sir, shall I expect you to be so mild and genteel?
Honestly, this half a minute might be it. Savor it while you can. Greta, oh, that's me girlfriend, says I might need years of therapy.
She sounds like a wise and caring companion, if I may say so.
That she is, and ye may.
Mananin has nothing to add. He keeps his head down and gives no indication he wishes to speak or be spoken to. We slog in silence most of the way to the Morrigan's nightmarish warren, or nest, or whatever she used to call it. I speak up before we walk in, though, once the ground firms up and dries out a wee bit.
Forgive me for asking, Mananin, but are ye well? I seen ye looking better.
He stops, considers, then looks up when he has an answer.
I am well physically, but I have essentially been confined to this plane for a while now, and I miss the ocean. I miss the sense of harmony I once felt. Both were more important to my happiness than I realized.
Fair enough. I hope my offer will allow ye to find that harmony again.
Let us hope together. Please enter and be welcome.
In fae circles, that's about as clear a guarantee of safety as one can expect. I step past the threshold and behold a room covered in bones. Not a floor, but all four walls, plus the ceiling. It's a whole lot of dead people's remains, shellacked and burnished and fitted together, set off by the occasional skull, grinning gumless at ye from the other side of the veil.
Well, I says, it's a bold look and that's no lie. Definitely a statement. Maybe not a statement of actual welcome, but it's a statement.
Do excuse the decor, Mananin says. The Morrigan had unusual tastes, and we have not had time to remodel.
He leads me through the next room, which contains a clear, narrow pool fed by three gurgling waterfalls. There's a chorus of eerie voices singing in a minor key, and it's the opposite of relaxing. I'm about to ask what fresh shite is this when Mananin offers an explanation.
The Morrigan would use this pool to cleanse blood from her body after she returned from her exertions. We don't know where the singing is coming from, and our efforts to make it stop have thus far been unsuccessful.
Ah, very practical of her, I says. That's thinking ahead, that is. Now that I see it, I can't understand why more homes don't have a room like this. Coriander snorts softly, and Mananin grunts, enjoying the dry commentary.
Refreshing blood baths, haunted by the voices of people you've slain. Blood rooms instead of mud rooms. Yes, they will soon be in the suburban homes of mortals everywhere.
I could probably use a bath, to be honest. I'm a mess, wearing half the fin on me front.
Mananin waves at the pool.
By all means, I will have clothing brought to you here.
I strip and wade in, and it's a cold pool, but not cold. It would be refreshing if not for the haunted cries wailing about the room. I do me best to wash off the wounds I've collected and use the energy in me knuckles to heal. Apart from that, I don't linger because it's a mite creepy, and some fae bring me a towel and some fresh clothes straight away. The next room is a long one, rather like the dimensions of a mead hall, full of helmets mounted on the wall, organized from oldest to newest. It would be a grand history of armor, I suppose, fit for any museum, except that the helmets still have skulls inside them. Trophies, Mananin says. Men who dared to give her insult over the centuries. The helmets give way to hats as the wars in Europe subsided, though I do spy an actual motorcycle helmet at the end, and some ball caps, plus a couple of fedoras. After that is the first genuinely pleasant room I've seen. There are two red upholstered chairs in front of a stone hearth, a wool rug spread out to buffer the feet from the cold floor, and gilt-framed paintings on the bone-free walls, illuminated by candles resting in sconces. Sure, the paintings are all of battlefields, and feature crows feasting on the staring eyes of the slain, but they're masterfully done. A reception by the rebellious Queen of the Fairies waits beyond, in a dining hall that's fair-sized but by no means large, since the Morrigan never expected to play hostess for more than a few. Fand, in contrast to Munanin, is feckin' resplendent. She's wreathed in frippery and fancy doodads and whatnots, and she radiates health and power. Maybe she's doing yoga, or had a superfood for breakfast. Greta says science cranks out miraculous solutions to aging every week, so many that you could spend your whole extended life trying them all out. But kale is worse than old man balls, she says. Though I don't rightly know what kale is, or why she hates it so much, or even when old man balls became a superfood. That whole conversation confused me, and I let it slide past, like much of the nonsense this modern age throws me way. Maybe Fand has been eating kale, or something else to make her look so fine. More likely she's simply glamoured. But if I peek in the magical spectrum, she'll know and be insulted. Better to just accept her magnificence at face value.
"Welcome, Coriander,"
she says, her voice warm and sweet like honey in summer. But when she turns to me, her voice is furry with hoarfrost.
"Hello, jailer."
Ah, she hasn't forgotten that bit then. I give her a shallow nod, less than her due, and force a friendly smile. "Fan, I appreciate you seeing me." She offers no reply to this, but waves at the spare table, set with a couple of cheese boards and some bottles of whiskey and wine. The room lacks anything fancy. Simple wood chairs, sunlight streaming through high windows, providing some weak light instead of candles, no tapestries or sculptures or seashell motifs like I saw in their place in Tir na n Og, stone walls and floors, no rugs. It's a different aesthetic from Munanin's estate, for sure. Minimalist, methinks it's called. Or miserable. I think the words may be related. Only Fand and Coriander stand out in this gloom. We sit, and Munanin pours me some whiskey that's been aged in stout beer barrels. It's a fine medley of flavours, and I feel it mellowing me bones almost immediately. Munanin pours a glass for himself and says, "Sláinte." But Fand reaches for wine, and Coriander follows her lead. I wonder if there's anything to that. Is it merely his preference, or is there some message there? Is he being diplomatic, or is he trying to signal to Fan that his sympathies lie with her? Me skills with nuances are often limited to being just aware enough of their existence to know that I'm probably missing them. Bloody nuances. Fand asks Coriander how the Fae are faring in Tir na n Og, and asks him to convey her fond regard. He agrees, and an awkward silence falls until Munanin asks about me grove of apprentices. Ah, they're grand, fast learners and pure hearts. They'll serve Gaia well.
I remembered suddenly that I did have one icebreaker at me disposal that hadn't failed yet.
Speaking of apprentices, did I ever tell you the totally true story about Sheehan, the Roman skirt, and the goat?
Fand frowns at the mention of his name, but a minute later she's snorting into her wine glass, and peals of laughter bounce off the walls.
Monaghan throws his head back to roar out loud with such force that he topples over in his chair and crashes to the floor. Coriander's face turns the colour of a tomato as he laughs hoarsely and tries to catch his breath. That story has done me more good winning people to me side than any bottle ever has, though the spirits no doubt help to loosen them up. They are all in a much better mood, then, when I give them Briot's offer. Ireland's at risk due to this Ragnarok business. Word is it's coming in a few days.
Fand nods. I'm not surprising her with anything.
I'm not the sort to be fancy with me words, so I'll say it plain. Briot wants your help, and then she'd like to welcome you home. Fight in Ragnarok. Save some lives to make up for the ones you took. Restore balance. Gain honour and renown the way the Tuatha Dé Danann are used to on the field of battle. And be welcome in Tír na n-Óg again.
Under her rule, the Iron Throne.
I
absolutely not.
I catch a flash of disappointment on Munanin's face. He'd like to take the deal, no doubt, so it's Fand that needs convincing.
Allow me to ask for clarification on one thing. Do ye object more to Briot's rule, or that she's doing it from the Iron Throne?
The throne, of course,
she spit, and the surprise on me face must have encouraged her to explain in more even tones.
It's that iron in the face of the Fae every day that makes her insufferable. It's both a threat and an insult. We know she's mastered iron, and we're unlikely to forget it. There's no need to terrorize the Fae with it at court every second.
I swing around to Coriander, Briot's herald extraordinary, to see if he agrees with this assessment. He winces and sucks at his teeth, and I have no idea if he's agreeing or what.
Be plain, lad. Don't just scrunch up your face at me like some swollen, pouty anus.
He flinches, and then says,
"Were we in private? I would agree with Fan's assessment."
I'm not gonna tell. I just need to know the truth of things, since I've obviously been away. So thank ye.
I turn back to Fand. I had no idea what Briot sat on with such a thorny issue. Have ye communicated this to her before?
We have, on many occasions. She refuses to even consider scrapping it.
And when was the last time?
Fand defers to Coriander to answer that.
I believe it was as recently as the 1960s, by human reckoning, when the Fae became upset at the existence of a mortal band called Iron Butterfly, and renewed their plea to rid the court of the scourge of iron.
The Fae got upset over a band name?
Never mind, of course they did. A better question is why ye think 60 years or more qualifies as recent.
Plenty has changed since then,
especially right now. Ye may have some leverage ye didn't have before. So let me pose a hypothetical, Fand. If I can get Briot to agree to ditch the Iron Throne, will ye fight in Ragnarok, then go home again to live in peace? She'd still be first among the Fae, mind, but you'd also have won something for them, wouldn't ye? And all would be forgiven. Munanin would have his ocean again. I gesture at the forlorn god of the sea, and Fan glances his way, seeing how desperately unhappy he is. I press on. He wouldn't be stuck in this fen surrounded by bones and cold stone walls. Sounds like the closest thing to harmony you're going to get.
What say you, husband? Fan asks.
I say it's a way back,
he replies,
and I think both the price and the reward are fair.
Fand leans forward,
selects a cube of Irish cheddar, and pops it gracefully into her mouth. She chews as she thinks it over, demonstrating that it is in fact possible to eat cheese beautifully. I'm thinking that the Beautiful Cheese Eaters is a far better band name than Iron Butterfly when Fan gives me an answer.
I am not so sure about the price. She gets rid of some furniture and in return gets an army. Still, it is, as you say, Munnanin, a way back. Very well, Owen. Speaking only for myself and the Fae host, if, and only if, Breit agrees to remove the Iron Throne from court, we will fight in Ragnarok for Ireland and then return to Tir na n'Og. Our rebellion forgiven, our possessions returned, and agree that Breit is first among the Fae to live in harmony again.
Very good, Munnanin,
I ask. Aye, he says. I too agree to this.
Coriander, do ye witness this?
I do.
Well then, if ye will excuse me, I have some more talking to do. I hope to have an answer for ye soon. I have plenty of hopes, in fact, as I leave that fen. So many that I think maybe this qualifies as an example of the second law of Owen. Sometimes ye can clean up the shite.
Chapter 6. I am so pumped full of adrenaline by the time we make it back to Katzper Guova's house that my hands are shaking as we enter. I had shifted to Flagstaff briefly to pick up the special stakes that Crania had given us to use in Rome, where merely breaking the skin anywhere would unbind the vampire in question. We had given them all to Owen for safekeeping and to help the werewolves defend against any vampires that might show up at the site of the grove. Owen and his grove weren't there, so it was simple enough to sneak in, take a pair of stakes, and sneak out again. Now I have one in my left hand as I descend into the vampire bunker, and Flidish has another. I carry my staff, Scowija, in my right hand, and Flidish carries her bow. We each turn invisible by prior arrangement as we enter the bunker proper and pause to listen. Nothing. We creep down to the library in silence and find it just as we left it. I'm tasked with finding the Scooby-Doo lever on the bookcase, and it takes me only moments before it's painfully obvious. Pull on the Polish translation of Bram Stoker's Dracula. And a click and scrape moves the bookcase aside. We are confronted with a hallway paneled in hardwoods and a floor covered in a plush burgundy carpet. Neither of us moves. We wait.
Hello?
A voice calls after a few moments, and then repeats it with a note of impatience.
Hello?
We remain in place. Opening the door was our move. The next one was theirs. A clear sigh of frustration meets our ears, and then some mumbled curses as the unseen guard or receptionist comes to investigate. It's a mustached man who carries himself like a fighter, but he's not prepared for an invisible ambush. Flidish plunges a stake into his throat, and he gurgles once before falling to his knees, clutching at the stake as blood wells around its circumference. He remains solid as he dies, a human thrall then and not a vampire. I figured there would be one or more guarding the place, and it's difficult for me to summon any sympathy for them, since they would not be thralls if they did not wish to prey on other humans. We wait a few moments more, and then Flidish hisses quietly at me to follow. I can't see her, but once I'm in the hallway, I see a desk with monitors behind it to the left. It's the thrall's security station. I go that way and run into Flidish by accident.
I'm rubbish at this,
she murmurs to me in Old Irish.
How do we proceed?
I duck around the desk and look at the banks of monitors and keyboards and so on. Everything's labeled in Polish. A moment, I say, trying to decipher what I'm looking at. There are views of multiple rooms, each filled with many men and women, lounging in chairs and talking over tables, but there's no way to tell which are vampires, which are thralls, and which are intended to be food. One room is stacked floor to ceiling with coffins on shelves. Strange vampire bunk beds, I suppose? but obviously in a more secure location than the few coffins we found in the rest of the facility. There are two buttons with biometric pads underneath them, one marked Library and one marked Sanctum.
"We're gonna need the body over here," I tell Flittish, and soon I can see the guard being hauled by an unseen force back to the station.
There are several buttons and switches under the general heading of alarm, but I don't know what they do. I'm afraid if I push any of them,